Ciao a tutti, and thank you for downloading this Bologna Institute for Policy Research podcast. The BIPR is the research division of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Europe. This seminar was recorded on April 23rd and features Stefania Milan, Associate Professor of New Media and Digital Culture at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Introducing her is Nina Hall, Assistant Professor of International Relations at ZEISS Europe in Bologna, Italy. Professor Milan's talk challenges us to consider how data impacts citizen activism, exploring the idea of proactive data activism in which big data is used for social change. Professor Milan predicts a paradigm shift in the relationship between states and citizens. She concludes that big data can actually be used to enhance citizenship, and further research will have to explore how governments respond to this changing relationship. We hope you enjoy this recording.
Welcome all. Thanks for coming along on such a gorgeous sunny day to listen to this evening's seminar series. I'm really, really delighted to introduce Stefania Milan, who will be speaking as part of a series that I'm hosting, Nina Hall, Assistant Professor here of International Relations, on politics beyond the state, politics in the internet era. So we've been looking throughout the last year and hosting a number of speakers talking about if and how the digital era is changing politics. And I think this evening's talk promises to be an excellent talk trying to tackle these issues. Stefania Milan is an Associate Professor of New Media and Digital Culture at the University of Amsterdam. Her research explores the interplay between digital technology, participation, activism, and social movements. She does a lot of very sort of more ethnographic research, going, talking with hacktivists. Also has looked at cyberspace governance and data epistemologies. She is the principal investigator of the Data Active Project, which is funded through one of the European Research Council's starting grants, and has worked at a vast array of universities. We were just talking about it on the way here. It was pretty amazing, from Toronto, Tilburg University, Central European University, University of Lausanne, Switzerland, and now in Amsterdam. To give you a bit more of a sense of some of Stefania Milan's work, she's written a book, Social Movements and Their Technologies, Wiring Social Change, which came out in 2013, and was co-author of Media Society. So she's written a lot exploring exactly these questions of how is it that social movements are using internet technologies in new and innovative ways to change politics. So I'm really looking forward to this evening's conversation. Stefania will speak for about half an hour. And seeing as we're a relatively small group, I'd really encourage you all to feel free to ask questions, probably afterwards, unless Stefania is happy to have interjections. And yeah, looking forward to the conversation. Thanks, Stefania.
Thank you very much, Nina. I understand I have to speak into the microphone. So my voice after a weekend with an Italian family has really suffered. So apologies for that. Well, I'm delighted to be here for a variety of reasons, not last because I am Italian, but also because I'm a great admirer of Nina's work. We met at a conference, it was probably about a year and a half ago or so, and then we are meant to reconnect in a way or another, so this is, I see, a step towards that. But it's also very interesting to see how, you know, I work in English, I work across the ocean, I changed many countries, so I'm very interested as an Italian national to see what happens when other people come to my own country. Probably I feel here as foreigner as many of you do, because I've been away for quite a while. And you probably heard my joke earlier when she said, actually, oh, there's going to be a little interview, it's going to be about the future of Italian politics. I was like, oh no, what can I say? So it's not going to be about that, luckily. But so thank you very much for coming. If I were you, partially because I live in the Netherlands, I would probably be sitting out there, if not, you know, sipping a spritz somewhere. In any case, I hope to entertain you a little bit. And as an Italian, I can speak forever. So that's why I have this the clock here. But otherwise, start rotating your eyes, make some signs, and please signal that it's enough. And I can stop anytime. I'm also happy to be interrupted at any time if whatever I say is not very clear, if you're curious about something. I do work with hackers, and as I was coming by train here, I got an email from my internet service provider that my website has been hacked, which is an interesting new experience, so don't go there right now, but the PowerPoint was already prepared, so I didn't bother changing it. Hopefully the issue is going to be resolved soon. But, well, I'm going to take you to a discussion on the future of democracy and citizenship. Not that I have any answer for such a large topic, but I would like to give you maybe some pointers, or more than anything, some, you know, raise some questions about some things that are happening around us. I'm a political scientist, although I work in a school of humanities at the moment, so I have not much sympathy for, you know, academic or disciplinary boundaries. So if there's anything that maybe you're not familiar with, again, please feel free to interrupt. So we live more or less in symbiosis with our portable device. You probably have seen me there playing around with two phones. Urban planners even talk about smartphone zombies. Cities are currently being, you know, urban planners are thinking about how to accommodate those with creative cross lights and stuff like that. But while we negotiate and refresh our digital self, spread over the many social networking platforms where our friends sort of hang out, and our existence unfolds in real life as much as it does on these digital platforms, and often simultaneously. And anytime we move around the city, we move around cyberspace, we leave an array of digital traces, like little footprints, and everything we do more or less turns into a database entry. It is something that, you know, it has been called datification. What is datification? It has been defined by these two beautiful people mentioned there, who were the first, back in 2013, to publish a book. I recommend it because it's quite colloquial and entertaining, a very academic book, which discusses what is happening around us. And they define datification as the ability to render into data many aspects of our life which have never been quantified before, such as relationships and emotions, for example. Think about, of course, the overly famous like button on Facebook. But really, what datification is ultimately about is monetizing our whereabouts, our identity, our feelings, and our preferences. Well, you, especially given this is an American college, I'm sure you're more sensitive than Italians are, given we live in a sort of digital divide here, but about the Cambridge Analytica case, you might recognize this picture. This is CEO, founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, testifying in Congress about, you know, the Cambridge Analytica case, overly famous by now. And I was particularly entertained by the fact that of the many questions that the senator asked this guy, they also ask, how can you actually offer services for free? And it's written, the quote is down there, very tiny, but the guy said, well, Senator, we run ads, in case you have not noticed. But so this is really what datification is all about. Although I still talk a lot about big data, but really the issue at stake now, it's more like artificial intelligence. So it's not just the fact that data are produced in large quantities, and, you know, there's software and machinery to make sense of it, and of ever larger quantities of data in a much faster, a much more meaningful manner. But really, we are confronted by algorithms now that take up a life of their own, in a way, the sort of, you know, they are self-training machines that one day, and this is already happening, including, for example, with Facebook algorithms, because they learn from their doings, they sort of are going to perform actions that are probably unintelligible to their very same creators. But I'm going to keep talking about big data. It's a little less threatening. And datification, and even more so looking forward, artificial intelligence, as Boyd and Crawford wrote, reframes key questions about the constitution of knowledge. And this is one of the starting points of my work. So in a way, it alters what we might call the social epistemology. So it changes the way we make sense of the world around us. Not just the nature of the world around us, that's something I'm going to get to in a moment, but also the way we experience and make sense and understand and relate to the world around us. It is, in a way, a novel, powerful system of knowledge which has really dramatically altered the conditions under which we make sense of the world, as I just mentioned. And I don't know whether you're familiar with this face. Probably you're not. Always ask this question. No one ever is, because the guy's not famous for his face. Marshall McLuhan, a Canadian scholar. The reason why I'm familiar with his face is that I used to work in a department next to where the guy worked. He's long dead now, but in the past. But he was a media theorist, a fairly interesting personality, who also tried to write books that were actually not consequent. Like, they were not printed like we normally print books. But what it's famous for its work on, for example, theorizing a little bit the global village, so, you know, globalization, what became later globalization. But he also sort of tried to theorize technology as the extension of man. So, for example, when he was writing the 50s, 60s, television then would be the extension of the human eye, because it would allow us as individuals to look further than our immediate surroundings, right? Think about a time in which there was no internet, and also there were not really low-cost flights, so the direct experience of the world of most people was relatively limited. So television was then expanding the horizons of people. Radio would be then the extension of the hearing of human beings, and so on and so forth. And in a way, what he was saying is that, you know, there is a paradigm shift with all this new mass media, and I'm paraphrasing his work, which is, of course, much more extended. But in a way, trying to imagine what would he say if he was alive today, we can see datification as a real paradigm shift that really alters our relation and understanding to the world. And in turn, and that's also part of his argument, changes us, reconstitutes us as individuals, but also, as we were going to see, as citizens. And this fundamental paradigm change that I personally believe it's really happening when we discuss statification, whether we are aware or not as final users of all the platforms and devices that we are going to use, has dramatic ontological and epistemological consequences. The epistemological consequences I've already mentioned, and the ontological is more like about the nature of things. So I do believe, similarly to what happened then, can you detect what that is about? What do you mean?
I'm sorry, I thought you were asking what the illustrations were.
Yeah, what the illustrations are about, yeah.
Okay, so Gnosticism was an early branch of Christianity which believed that there was some sort of hidden truth behind the world, and that a study of knowledge would reveal this hidden truth, and that eventually, like the picture says, mm-hmm. you'd almost like poke your head through existence and see a deeper understanding of the mm-hmm. universe. Like through kind of like it also had a strange narrative that God was actually evil, and that mm-hmm. Jesus was, his message was to deliver this hidden truth and to teach others how to look outside of reality.
Well, this is very interesting, and I never had this comment on these pictures. I'm very curious, no, that I'm learning myself, so thank you very much for that. Maybe you can give me a reference. It's much more, you know, the basic level. This is the depiction of two cosmic views, so the views of the universe. So this is the Earth, where the sun rotates around, so a flat universe with the sun rotating around, and this is the modern Copernican view with, you know, the solar system. So in a way, what I want to point to is that what happened with datification is similar to this paradigm change. As I said, whether we are aware or not, it's a pretty big change. And with artificial intelligence, that's going to be even more the case. Looking more concretely at what it means in practice, well, we can talk about, for example, data capitalism. So this is ultimately a business model, a very successful business model implemented by a number of companies that have, as it should be, because they're private companies, profit on top of their sort of value scale, if you want. And unfortunately, this has some consequences for, as the Cambridge Analytica case has brought to our attention, some potentially dramatic consequences on democracy or liberal democracy as we know it right now. So in a way, what we can say is a sort of bit provocative statement or hypothesis is that data capitalism accelerates datification, call it the way you want, because it's more or less the same thing they were talking about. Depends on what you prefer to emphasize. Accelerates the ongoing crisis of liberal democracy. So we know that there's, you know, decreasing voter turnout, disaffection of young people for, you know, traditional systems, traditional ways of political participation. Well, cases like Cambridge Analytica, you know, make things even more severe in a way, make problems bigger. I have to say that my group in Amsterdam has been looking at Cambridge Analytica for the last 3 years. So we have been working on that a little longer than the last few weeks. And so that's probably where our, you know, our pessimism about the future of democracy comes from. However, at the same time, we also have a very optimistic narrative that I'm going to share with you in a minute. So if datification alters the social epistemology, it also alters the social ontology. So in a way, the nature, the very same nature of democracy, and in particular, the role of technology in the constitution of the social. And that's what I would like to explore with you today. This work is not done by myself alone. It's a little ambitious. It's still ambitious anyway. But as is often the case, things are more fun when they're done in a group. So the Data Active, later there's going to be a picture, is a group, is a research team of about 10 people at the moment that work on, well, they try to understand the evolution of civic participation and activism vis-a-vis datification. We are in the year 3 of our project, and we cover a lot of ground, including, for example, governance of data flows. And as I said, ultimately, in a very ambitious, forward-looking manner, we like to think about the future of democracy. But that's something we're still working on. We don't have much evidence about that yet. It's interesting to, I think, deconstruct a little bit what we mean by data and what we mean by technology, because we do work with data and technology. I said big data, not all the data that we look at, as we're going to show with some examples, are actually that big. Sometimes they're also very small. But both data and technology deserve, we believe, a slightly different approach. So in a way, we go all the way back to, you know, we are in Europe. We all study ancient Greek and Latin here. Not all, but a lot of us. And so it's quite common to go back to the original etymology, which is usually Greek, often, of nouns. And in the case of technology, it comes from techne, which doesn't actually indicate a tool or something, you know, secondary that allows you to do something else. But it actually indicates the process of making, the craftsmanship, the sort of craft, the quality that, in a way, art and engineering in common. And in that sense, this is actually something that comes from cultural studies, which is not my field, but it's the only reference to a different approach to technology that I've found. Techne refers to the human ability to make and perform. And so from this perspective that you understand why we are very much interested in the practices of citizen engagement with data and technology, because data technology, but also platforms and devices, are much more than just tools. They're a system of relationship, a system of governance as well. What we do in Amsterdam, you see some of the questions, probably you cannot read them, it's a snapshot from our website. But the questions we're after are, how do people use big data to foster social change and, you know, engage in civic participation and so on? How do citizens resist massive data collection? This project emerged right after the Snowden case and the NSA scandal, so then you understand why the aspect of resistance become very important. And ultimately, which is the third question that is probably something that is of most relevance to political scientists, and in fact is the part for which I'm going to hire specifically someone from international relations. Because the question is, how does data datification, massive data collection, affect the dynamics of the transnational civil society, including, for example, transnational advocacy networks and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, but also their participation in, for example, multi-stakeholder governance and stuff like that. But this is the part that, unfortunately, is planned for year 4 and 5 of the project. So the angle, the sort of the lens that we use to look at all these questions, which are actually many more than the ones that I put there, is the lens of data activism. What is data activism and why? So data activism is a useful way of thinking about the relation between data, technology and people. And it refers to ways for citizens to engage with data and technology. In a way, if you look at the more collective aspect of it, it refers to mobilizations that take a critical stance towards massive data collection. So people who do not like, for example, what is happening with Cambridge Analytica, people who are not very happy with the NSA scandal, PRISM, and all of that, but also people that believe that actually there's a lot hidden in big data. There are opportunities that people can use to engage with the state, for example, and exercise their citizenship. Data activism emerges from other pre-existing movements, for example, the hacker scene. I mentioned I spend a lot of time with hackers and our underground internet users, but also open source software developers, so people who develop their own software because they don't like proprietary software. But it increasingly involved ordinary users. And this was really what triggered my interest back in 2014 when I wrote this proposal for this project. Because in a way, what I'd been observing for a number of years already happening in the fringes of civil society all of a sudden became much more mainstream. Mainstream is still, you know, is still for a certain elite or for the people who are anyway interested or able to engage with software themselves. But it is increasingly something for that is of appeal to more people. And then, you know, cases like Cambridge Analytica actually help my argument in a way, if you want, sadly. Data activists are individuals and groups that try to make sense of data as a way of knowing the world, what I mentioned about the epistemologies, but they try to turn it into a point of intervention. They're also producers, these activists or these citizens, of alternative epistemologies and alternative data counterculture, and in a way producers of counter-expertise, precisely to counteract the over-positivistic ethos of big data and datification, the fact that we can only know by quantifying things and only know by numbers, or that statistics are and algorithms are the answers to a lot of social problems, for example, which is true, but only in part. When we look at people's forms of engagement with data, then we notice how, as I already mentioned, in a way, big data datification can be seen as a sort of novel big brother, so a form of gigantic control, much more extensive, much more pervasive, but also as a set of novel opportunities. And I give you a few examples. Well, we use two broad categories. They're analytical categories, so in fact we are talking about a continuum here, not boxes. But in order to understand different attitudes toward technology and data, it's useful to think in terms of this continuum. And on the one side, you have what we call proactive data activism, so people who see the optimistic side and want to use, leverage big data for social change or for the exercise of citizenship. And on the other hand, you have the reactive side, those that react to what they perceive to be an external threat. So, you know, people who, for example, engage in the creation of encryption systems to avoid government snooping. And I provide you some examples. The pictures are a little dark, probably, for you, but you might recognize there Obama. You might also remember the slogan that helped me to help him to win the presidency the first time. Yes, we can. That after this Snowden revelation became, yes, we scan. You also probably recognize this, probably not. That's PGP, pretty good privacy, that allows everyone, actually, from your own machine, not really from the phone properly, but from a desktop or a laptop to encrypt your communication. So this prevents potential servers from reading the content of your mails. And the last one there, there's the White Rabbit and Alice in Wonderland, but really what they're talking about is encryption. So this is an advertising poster for a crypto party. And I'm not sure everyone is going to understand this reference, but crypto party have been equal to the Tupperware parties for learning crypto. If you remember these Tupperware parties where, you know, women typically would gather in someone's living room and exchange advice on these boxes. Essentially, what a crypto party is about is like exchanging expertise, so teaching non-experts to learn to use cryptography, mostly email cryptography. This was, you might recognize, 1984. This was the largest, this was a huge room with 9,000 hackers a few years back in Berlin, in Hamburg, the biggest hacker congress in Europe, probably in the world. That this was the reaction to the Snowden revelations. There was a group more recent, in 2012, who were already writing, well, we actually have to talk about Facebook. Facebook is the biggest surveillance system that we have at the moment, that not we have as activists, but that they have. Therefore, we have to problematize the fact that, you know, there is this, as the sort of picture, the vignette shows, you know, people tend to be happy to hang out there because it's free. But in fact, we are the products. But what this group of activists try to point out is that, in fact, not only is bad because we participate in this sort of data capitalism, but it's also bad because Facebook allows for social graphs to be exposed. And if you're an activist, then this facilitates the work of those that might want to repress your activism. But as I said, we are not only concerned about very gloomy stories. We are also very much enthused by other more entertaining stories. So these are a series of projects that try to leverage big data for social change. For example, the top screenshot is from Open Spending, which is a platform that allows everyone to analyze, to access and analyze and compare public spending figures from I think, over 100 countries at the moment, and it's being updated regularly. So the idea is that by making data available, you also create more active citizens. And you can also, you know, through, for example, mechanism like open data, help the state to improve its output. So the idea is not confrontational here, but it's an idea of collaboration with institution in order to ameliorate public services, for example. Hackers instead refers to, actually, hack stays funny enough for journalists. Hackers, what you know. And hackers is a global network of individuals who either they're good storytellers, like journalists, or they're good at crunching data, like hackers, and they come together to create stories which are appealing and, you know, might help the world to become a better place. This is, it's impossible for you to see this, I'm sorry about that, it's a very dark picture, but I do recommend looking up the video that this comes from, which is called The Left to Die Boat. And I would like to spend a couple of minutes, although I'm really running out of time, to discuss this story because I think it's very interesting, but also because it's something that touches Italy from very close. This, you don't really see it, but this is Sicily, this is Italy, and this is Northern Africa, this is Libya. And the blue part that you probably cannot really see, this is a satellite image of the Mediterranean. So that part between southern Italy and North Africa. And it's probably the most surveilled portion of sea in the world at the moment, because of course the European Union is trying to prevent illegal migration from coming into Italy and therefore also having access to the Union. So there's a number of forces there play. There's the vessels, there are planes, there's all kinds of surveillance systems besides the fact that the seas are surveyed and monitored. So there's, if you are a vessel carrying fish or containers, you anyway carry some, you know, satellite communication systems that, you know, you can prevent crashes and stuff like that. So there's a combination of pre-existing and new monitoring systems. And in 2012, there was a boat with 84 migrants that left the Libyan coast. Of course, in pretty precarious conditions. Shortly afterwards, their engine stopped working and they were drifting into the sea. And they were there for 12 days. Not surprisingly, the majority of them died. Only 9 survived. And eventually, the boat was washed back to Libya. And they were found there. And one of the people that was rescued told the story of, well, you know, many, both airplanes and helicopters and vessels were near us. They saw us. We tried to attract their attention. They ignore us. You know, try to imagine this is someone who has lost his passport, probably doesn't even want to say where it comes from anyway, because he wants to improve his possibilities of applying for asylum. It's back in Libya where he's probably put into, you know, some sort of camp, which is actually, you know, torture camps and jails. And so this is someone who has no agency whatsoever. The story came, some people in London came across this story. It's a research group actually at Goldsmith University, and it's called the Forensic Architecture. They were working actually with a grant similar to mine, but what they did was to try to corroborate the story of these migrants. So let's see whether that's true. And they went after all this data, which are publicly available for the most part. When they were not publicly available, they paid for them, because very often they are commercially available then. And they were able to see that, yes, in fact, it was absolutely right. Several vessels were in the vicinity and they ignored the boat in the hope that the boat would drift some other continental waters. And on the basis of this data, so this excellent case, I believe, of data activism, they were able to actually bring the NATO, which was in charge of that part of the sea, to court on the crime of non-assistance at sea, which, you know, if you know international law a little bit, yeah, you can tell it's a pretty big one. It's still, the case is still ongoing, but I think this is an excellent example of how you can put existing data at the service of social change, in a way, of for the good. This is another example. I have to accelerate a little bit, but this is Camera V. Camera V is an app for your phone. You can download it, and what it does is it attaches to any picture that you might take with your phone data that are either available through the phone anyway or additional metadata that make sure that that precise information has sufficient side information, which are the metadata, right, to be used as evidence in court. So if you come across a human rights violation, this was not created for people, lucky people like us living in this beautiful city, but for people living in authoritarian countries, and would come across something, they would want to report it, but they are picture would not count in court. Thanks to this, and by the way, everything is encrypted, storing your phone, so also the privacy of the individual taking the picture is preserved. Thanks to this app developed by an NGO, you can do that now. This is another example. This is a sticker. These activists have amazing stickers and stuff. But these are people, it says, we make data love. And there are groups that try to leverage data for the global good, as I said. But, as I mentioned already before, not all data are big. This is my field work. Since you really don't see the picture, the picture itself is very ugly. I mean, it's very, very poor quality because this is Colombia. Magdalena Medio apartheid is not even mentioned in The Lonely Planet because it was till not long ago. We had a huge problem with political violence and the guerrilla and the paramilitaries. If you know the story of Colombia, you know what we're talking about. This is a woman, Maria, not a fisherwoman, not a man also. I'm mentioning this because she's using information and data to work with fishermen, and she's not an expert of fishing, but she is concerned about the ecosystem or of the Magdalena River where she lives. This is a portion, it's a huge, huge river in Colombia that has a number of side rivers and lakes and stuff like that. And these are, you know, fragile ecosystems, but especially these fragile ecosystems provide provide basically food and work, very informal economies, but for a large number of people. But there is also this area, there's a lot of coal mines and gold mines. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of other minerals, by the way. It's a valuable area, and therefore they are trying to change. I mean, a corporation coming in, changing the course of the river, messing it up, people cannot fish, and there's a number of other, I mean, I can tell you more details. But what this woman is doing is she's running workshops with fishermen, and at the beginning it was very difficult for her to run these things, precisely because she's a woman and not an expert of fishing. But she's also not someone who has a particularly high degree of anything. She just went to primary school. But what she does is she runs these workshops. They draw together in a very sort of ethnographic manner without having any knowledge of the methodology. They draw together the river, the various portions of the rivers in a historical fashion as well. So 5 years ago it was like this, blah, blah. And then she goes home and she creates this very beautiful, huge, huge, huge fabrics, I mean posters, so to speak, but in a big piece of fabric. And she goes with this stuff to advocate for environmental policies in the local municipalities. And it's been pretty successful also because these maps are much more accurate than satellite maps that they have used so far, that even the institution have used so far. But for me, it's very interesting because it's a very, very small data, very different from all the very technological stuff that I mentioned before. So I'm already at 32 minutes, so I finally get to talk about citizenship and also quickly coming to a conclusion. As I said, we are still working on all of this, but one of the ways that we are that we approach data activism from is to imagine what if data activism is simply a new way of thinking about citizenship. We're not talking about the citizenship in, you know, passport terms. We're talking about active citizenship, and we're talking about the process of political participation. So typically, we activate ourselves as citizens mostly through voting. I mean, also through other things like paying taxes and respecting rules when we're driving and stuff like that. But typically, when we have a say, is literally just when we vote, which is, well, in Italy, a little more frequently than the US. You know, still relatively infrequently. And so what if data activism signals, or, you know, a number of ways, because it's not just one, as I mentioned through the examples before, a number of ways to rethink the way that we can be citizens today. In a way, we can really see data activism as a number of practices that revitalize the citizens' democratic agency. The fact that you might be familiar with apps such as Fix My Street, which, you know, allow to you to directly report from, you know, the pothole or ask for, you know, the street lamp and stuff like that to be fixed. This is also a way to interact with state institutions, local institutions in particular. There's a number of these instances, these platforms. There's a lot of apps. There's a lot of devices. Not all of that is mediated by technology, but most of it is. But I like really to see it as something that dramatically alters the relationship between the state and its citizens. By making the exchange between the state and the citizens much more frequent, but also bringing it into a sort of quotidian practice. And the politics of the quotidian is actually, strangely enough, comes from Colombia, not from that case. just realize now that it comes from the experience of community radios in Colombia. I didn't put the reference there because I think it is actually there, but it's not in white, so probably that's why it doesn't show. But there is a scholar with actually a career in the US, but with Colombian origin, who has done a lot of work with communities that have been subjected to extreme forms of violence. So these are communities in the mountains that are basically what happened was that for a number of years, these communities were taken hostage, literally, although that's not the language they used, but taken hostage by paramilitary groups of the guerrilla, so used as a sort of currency for the release of prisoners or whatever. So what would happen to these communities is that, you know, these are small villages, and they declare a curfew. Whoever is harassing them at that precise moment, and it was from various sites, they would say, okay, curfew, no one goes out, you cannot go shopping, you cannot go to school, you cannot go to work. And this would last several months sometimes. So there are also some very concrete problems like, you know, starving and stuff like that, but that's another story. What I want to talk about is how can these communities get out of these processes of these very big shocks that left them completely alienated also from each other, because very often the people exerting violence on them were people from the village. And what the scholar Clemencia Rodriguez found is that community radios were extremely important. And community radios were important not just for, you know, for the act of making radio, but because they would allow people to imagine a different world, to imagine a different type of relations, and to exercise a different type of relation also with their institution. Talk directly to the institution, invite the institution, be heard, but also simply gain back, reclaim back a voice that he had lost completely and probably had never had before. Also because the relation with the state had always been very, very fragile. Think about remote mountainous areas. And what she said is really that technology in that case, radio broadcasting, but I extend the argument to data and technology as making, as I mentioned before, enable people to activate their citizenship, to enact literally their citizenship on a daily basis. And in this process, to alter the relation between the state and the citizens. Now, this is very introductory, so we are doing a number of interviews, we are doing also some big data analysis ourselves, we are also developing our own software to do this, but we have some evidence of this which couldn't fit in half an hour, I'm already at 37 minutes talk, but that's what we are observing, that data activism, both in the sort of proactive and reactive approaches, so both the defensive and the more optimistic approaches to data identification, contribute to activate citizens in an unprecedented manner. And it's very interesting to see also how governance then changes in response to that. But to conclude, I would just like to say that, yes, this is all very exciting for us observing this. It's very exciting for the people that participate in this type of activities. But at the same time, we also observe, in a way, these activities map onto existing inequalities. So to do a lot of this, you need the expertise, you need sometimes machinery, not necessarily as we've seen with the Colombian case, but there are possibly new divides that match and amplify old divides. The 90s, we were talking much about the digital divide. Now we have still the digital divide, but we also have data divides. And what we have seen, for example, is that looking at the realm of non-governmental organizations, you have a big distinction between the have and the have nots. Those that, for example, can leverage big data in their campaigns and narratives. Think, for example, about Greenpeace, who develops his own apps and, you know, activates people and the relation with policymakers in a certain manners. And those that don't have these capacities and therefore are really a little left out of the narrative. If you now if you organize a campaign on values alone, without evidence or statistics, you have far less chances to be heard and taken seriously. So this is what I mean. This is just some of the inequalities. There are also the classical form of class and gender inequalities, given a lot of the activists and citizens we're talking about are white, are male, are educated. Not necessarily. The case of this Colombian woman was actually the opposite, but I think it's important also not to just overemphasize the enormous abilities that this brings about, but also the fact that we need to critically assess this and think about the consequences at a much broader level. These are some of my people. They're actually more. It's a bit of an old picture. We are 10 at the moment. And this is the website Data Activism that has not been hacked, so that one can be visited. And thank you very much, and sorry for speaking a little longer than planned.
Thank you for downloading this Bologna Institute for Policy Research podcast. Your reviews and feedback are welcomed in iTunes and on Stitcher. For more information on BIPR, please go to bipr.edu. Bologna, Italy is home to CICE Europe, which for over 60 years has used its strategic position in the heart of Europe to train leaders in international affairs worldwide. Learn more about degrees in international relations, international public policy, and global risk at www.cice-jhu.edu/Europe.